Good afternoon. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau and KRNN FM in Juneau here on Friday, the 13th of February, the year 2015. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Dana Mackey about the Career Education School at the Technical Education Center downtown. Marion Call will be here to highlight a musical party happening this Saturday at the Paradise Bakery. We'll talk with Joshua Howe, the featured speaker at tonight's fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. He'll be talking about climate change in a new light. Find out about Tuesday's celebration of Elizabeth Redfish Day at the Douglas Library. That writer's almanac for a note, music, and more today on the Juneau afternoon, live at 3. Greeted at 4 on KRNN and available live online at ktuo.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A handful of village public safety officers in western Alaska could be the first VPSOs in the state to carry firearms. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
A pilot project to arm the first VPSOs has seven candidates in the middle of intensive psychological testing before they advance to training. Captain Andrew Merrill is the Alaska State Troopers commander of the VPSO program.
This pilot project is going to help us design, you know, to review the training process we're using, to look at our selection process, to determine whether it's too strict or whether it's too loose, and to figure out exactly what's going to work best to make sure that we're providing that safe service to our communities and to keep our VPSOs safe.
In 2014, the Alaska legislature passed a law to allow VPSOs to carry guns. It was spurred by the death of a VPSO in Manicotic. In many communities, VPSOs are the only law enforcement. The VPSO, their community, and their nonprofit employer all have to agree to move ahead. For officers who make it through a long series of tests, officials are planning a 21-day course in March. Merrill says that training on the use of force builds on years of preparing troopers for rural Alaska law enforcement.
What options are available to use in different situations based on the totality of what's happening? How does that best apply to resolving the situation as safely as possible?
The VPSOs will use the same 40 caliber Glock pistol that troopers carry, and each VPSO will be paired with a state trooper for experience in an urban part of the state. The trooper will spend time in the VPSO's community for observation and training. Alvin Jimmy is the AVCP VPSO program coordinator, the employer of YK Delta VPSOs. He emphasizes teamwork and collaboration over the coming months.
Working cohesively together as a team to establish the pros and cons towards it, and that's the best way to, from my perspective, to approach it.
The VPSO's anticipated graduation from the academy is April 3rd. For National Native News, I'm Ben Matheson in Bethel, Alaska.
27 of Washington State's 29 tribes are hoping to amend their gaming compacts so that tribes can add more slot machines when needed without red tape and lengthy negotiations. Tristan Autone has more.
Currently, there are around 28,000 slot machines in Washington State. When tribal casinos notice that they need more machines, they have to negotiate to add more, and the way the system currently works, if one tribe gets more machines, all of them get more machines. This afternoon, Washington gambling commissioners will vote to essentially put that process on autopilot. Instead of lengthy negotiations with the state, feds, and a single tribe, an amended gaming compact will allow all nations to add more slot machines when there is a need without cumbersome arbitration. Chris Stearns is chairman of the Washington State Gambling Commission.
If there are less than 500 machines across the entire state that are available for use, that are basically sitting idle, then a tribe can request a 50-machine increase.
Under the amended compact, instead of meeting with state and federal officials to add a few dozen machines to meet market needs, the state's gambling commission will be the regulatory authority making that decision and streamlining the process. The amended compact goes before commissioners today, then must be approved by tribes, the governor, and the federal government. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autown.
The White House launched the Gen-I Native Youth Challenge Thursday in Washington, D.C. at a national conference. Youth are encouraged to share positive stories using digital platforms. Those 14 to 24 nonprofits and educational institutions are invited to join. It's part of the administration's effort to improve the lives of Native youth. Valentine's Day cards made by students, churches, and Cherokee Nation citizens are being delivered to veterans today in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Tribal leaders and students will hand them out at a VA medical center. It's part of the tribe's Valentine's for Veterans program. Cards were also delivered to nursing homes this week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau and Karen Ann FM in Juneau. Jeff Friday hosting you for a Juneau afternoon today. First guest is Dana Mackey from the Career Education School at the Technical Education Center downtown. Dana, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having me on this Friday the 13th, Valentine's Day Eve.
Lucky you, you get to be on the show with me.
I'm so happy to.
You're the incoming president for the Alaska Association of Career and Technical Education. It's a mouthful.
It is. It is a mouthful. The association is there to be able to provide professional development for our secondary and post-secondary teachers, along with making sure that industry knows what is happening in career and technical education around the state.
And you got the governor to declare career education.
We did. This month, for the month of February, is Career and Technical Education Month, and Governor Walker has signed a proclamation right before February started of saying that this is Career and Technical Education Month for the state.
What kind of careers are we talking about here?
Career and technical education involves all kinds of anything that's in the workforce. Particularly in our school of career education, we have diesel and mine mechanics, we have construction folks, we have health science folks. Career and technical education also involves anything in business, accounting, culinary arts, computer science type classes, and welding, all kinds of anything that you're doing out in the workforce, that is pretty much what would follow as career and technical education.
And this month you're offering three special Saturday sessions.
We are. The UAS School of Career Education is offering, actually we're offering five different sessions for three different weekends. So this Saturday, next Saturday, and the Saturday after next, in celebration of CTE month, and also an opportunity for folks to come see what we're doing, and then also maybe take away or learn something that they haven't learned before.
Who's your main audience?
Our main audience is actually anyone in the community. Starting this Saturday, tomorrow from 2 to 4, we have basic car maintenance. So if you don't know anything what to do of how to maintain your car, you can come in and we can show you just some simple things by checking your fluids, changing your light bulbs, or even changing the wiper blades. Also tomorrow we have window installation and flashing. That is being put on by one of our professors. He's just going to show you what to do correctly in installing a window. So that's for any age can really come in to do that, but probably you would be looking for more of an adult. But then we have, during February 28th, the last Saturday of the month, we have our mind simulator. I'm not sure if folks know much about our mind simulator. We obtained our mind simulator about 3 years ago now. The mind simulator, I kind of call it as like a big video game. You walk in, we have four different modules that we can set you in of a different type of truck that would run in an underground mine. And it's kind of a 180 view of what an underground mine looks like, and you're driving that truck through it. And let me tell you, I drove that truck through it, and I scraped a lot of walls, and that truck probably did not come out looking very well. But that is something that any age could come in and try and experience that experience with the simulator.
Sounds like Disneyland without the measles.
It's Disneyland without the measles. We can hope we won't have any measles.
Oh, you have some other Saturday sessions coming up as well?
We do. So next Saturday, we also have spring maintenance for your marine cooling system, so for your boats. Our assistant professor, Neil Volkers, is going to talk to you about inspecting and changing zincs, clean sea strainers and change your fuel filters. I told Neil I have no idea what those words mean, but you better believe I'll be there to learn what that is in case I ever have a boat or if I'm ever asked to help with a boat.
And the last session?
Our last session is the last Saturday of this month, February 28th. We're going to we have Assistant Professor Robin Gilchrist, who's going to show us how to obtain a building permit. So if you're starting on doing a remodel this summer, or you just have a new dwelling that you want to start some construction projects on, she'll show you how to do those building permits.
Tell me a little bit more about the Career and Technical Education Center.
Yeah. So the Technical Education Center is located downtown across the street from Juno Douglas High School on the harbor side. In that school, we have all kinds of different programs. We have a one-year occupational endorsement, one-year certificate program, and then we have a two-year Associates of Applied Science. Within those programs, we have like I said, diesel mechanic, mine mechanic, marine oiler, engine room prep, construction technology, health sciences, pre-nursing, pre-rad tech, and then we just have also some short-term classes. Those short-term classes, one of them just began this last Tuesday. It was called Introduction to Drywall. We have a few more that will start the 1st of March. Those include, we have a deck building class, a spring home maintenance class. We have a basic welding class that will begin around that time, and some other classes. I encourage anyone to take a look at our website. You can look at the UAS School of Career Education website, or just do a search on the UAS website. That's uas.alaska.edu. And check up the courses that start beginning of March. Some of them start mid-March. And it's not too late to sign up for any classes if you're looking to do something for the summer. Oh, we do have one more that I always think is really interesting because I'm about to start a remodel project this summer. We have a plumbing class that will start in March, too. So
I'm interested to know, like for the welding class, how often does that meet? How long does it meet? And then what does it cost?
So for our basic welding is offered, we have two different sessions this semester. One, we're just about to wrap up. The second one will start in March. And that class meets for two nights a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, from 6 p.m. to about 10:45 p.m. So for those that are going to work and want to go after work, this is a perfect class for you just to learn some of those basic welding techniques. We will offer this class again in the fall. That class will start around August 31st, same time, same days, Tuesdays and Thursdays. And so by the time you're finished, you will at least have some type of knowledge of some welding.
Before we go, could you give an overview of the classes, the sessions coming up this weekend and the following weekends?
Yes. So this Saturday, we have basic car maintenance with Assistant Professor Tom Dolan. We also have window installation and flashing by Assistant Professor Justin Fantasia. Next Saturday, we have spring maintenance for marine cooling systems by Assistant Professor Neil Volkers. And then on February 28th, we have CyberMine Mine Simulator demonstrations by the Director of Center for Mine Training, Mike Bell. And then we have getting a building permit by Assistant Professor Robin Gilchrist. All of these are 2 to 4 p.m. for the following Saturdays of this month at the Technical Education Center across the street from Juno Douglas High School on the harbor side.
And it's all free?
All free, yes.
Dina, thank you very much for coming in today. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I don't think so, but I appreciate your time and thank you for this Friday the 13th.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 13th of February, 2015. It's the birthday of the true crime writer William Roughead, born in Edinburgh, Scotland, 1870, a lawyer, loved murder trials, went to see them at the High Court, Edinburgh, which he then wrote up as narratives and published in his book, 12 Scott's trials in 1913. Henry James liked his work, so did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and President Franklin D. Roosevelt reserved a special shelf near the Oval Office just for the books of William Roughead. Despite his dry humor and his irony, Roughhead's long study of criminal depravity never turned him pessimistic. He said, "The study of criminology has by no means made me a cynic. It has encouraged my admiration for the ingenuity of the human race." It's the birthday of the painter Grant Wood near Anamosa, Iowa, 1891, known for the Portrait of a Farmer and his spinster daughter, American Gothic, which, along with the Mona Lisa, is one of the most familiar paintings in the world. Grant Wood grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, went to art school in Minneapolis, then Chicago, went to Europe, where he saw the work of Jan van Eyck, the 15th century Flemish painter, and was influenced by it. It was in homage to van Eyck that Wood painted those stylized fields and rolling hills of Iowa, and those lit scenes with long shadows. In a new biography entitled Grant Wood, A Life, R. Tripp Evans presents Wood as a closeted homosexual who adopted Midwestern regionalism as a shield for his own bohemianism, and who, when he died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 50, was planning to leave Iowa and move to California. And it's the birthday of the first man to travel faster than the speed of sound, Chuck Yeager, born in Myra, West Virginia, 1923 on this day, a fighter pilot in World War II who became a test pilot in the Air Force flying the rocket-powered Bell X-1 airplane. October the 14th, 1947, he broke the sound barrier, though he had fallen off a horse 2 days before and broke a couple ribs, but he didn't tell anyone about that. He went up in his plane to an altitude of 45,000 feet, did what he was supposed to do, and 14 minutes later, he was back on the ground. Here's a poem for today by Theodore Rethke, in praise of prairie. The elm tree is our highest mountain peak, a 5-foot drop, a valley, so to speak. A man's head is an eminence upon a field of barley spread beneath the sun. Horizons have no strangeness to the eye. Our feet are sometimes level with the sky. When we are walking on a treeless plain with ankles bruised from stubble of the grain, the fields stretch out in long, unbroken rows. We walk aware of what is far and close. Here, distance is familiar as a friend. The feud we kept with space comes to an end. In Praise of Prairie by Theodore Rethke, from his selected poems published by Anchor Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. And by Grove Press, publishers of The Big Seven by Jim Harrison, the story of a hapless detective up against a family of outlaws and his struggle to come to grips with the seven deadly sins, in bookstores everywhere. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 19 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau on KRNN-FM 102.7 in Juneau. In the studio with me now is Marion Call, here to talk about a mustache mimosa brunch, which is going on tomorrow at the Paradise Cafe out the road.
Yeah, now they've moved out to the valley, and Joan at Paradise Cafe got her beer and wine license, which is cause for celebration, I think. So that's going to be a big party that she's throwing. She would be here herself, except, of course, she's at the cafe making croissant dough right now, I'm sure.
And it's open from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the afternoon?
Yeah, the cafe is open from 8 till 2 or 8 till 3, I think. And we're going to have a more distinguished party time with music and events from 10 till 1 tomorrow morning. So it's a good way to kick off Valentine's Day weekend.
So you yourself are playing?
I will be playing, yeah, with Laura Zahasky, and we'll have some other fun music. I'm making a playlist of a lot of Alaskan artists to play in the background, and it's going to be kind of a stand and mingle and eat and talk and drink and some fun with mimosas, but it's also all ages, so I'm sure there's going to be kids, too. It'll be a good time.
A virgin mimosa.
Virgin mimosa, yeah, of some kind.
So what's it about mustaches?
What's about mustaches? Well, the new bar that she's opening, which is just in a corner of Paradise. Oh, that sounds nice, in a corner of Paradise. The new bar she's opening is called the Handlebar, and she's just going to be serving beer and wine. I think she's only staying open a little bit later through happy hour to do tapas. And, of course, then in the morning there's mimosas and bloody beer along with her great pastries and quiche and everything. So to kick off that experience, she's got her first shipment of beer this week and wine, and we're having this kind of beginning party, I guess, to kick off the Handlebar. And since it's called the Handlebar, it's a mustache-themed event, so do bring your mustache if you come, Jeff. I hope you will.
Now, what if you don't have a mustache?
Oh, I'm going to Sharpie some on my fingers, and then I can have different choices of mustache for every occasion. And I happen to know some gentlemen who have special dispensation from wives or girlfriends to convert their beer into a mustache for this occasion, and I know that that does not happen often. So, special event.
The Handlebar talks about the bicycles that are also in the...
That's right, yes, the bicycles. And her, I think her logo is a mustache, and then she has a bunch of bicycles on the wall. So between them, whichever you can easier get a hold of, I guess, while you're there. It'll be fun.
And remind me what time this starts.
It's 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, and it's to kick off Valentine's Day weekend. So whatever your evening plans are, since there's so much going on in town, I think this is a good morning way to start the weekend, right?
All right, Mary and Carl, thanks for coming in. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just that Joan Deering is really, she's amazing. And Paradise has been in business for so long now. And oh my goodness, I know anyone who's been there knows it's just one of the more striking eating establishments in town. And oh my goodness, the stuff she makes there. So any excuse to go is good by me. And I'm happy that she's doing so well at the new location in the Valley. It's good to have something like that in the Valley.
So I guess it's not the easiest thing in the world to get a beer and wine license.
It is not. It was a long struggle for her, and I think it was a nice victory. She's excited to be serving a sort of afternoon and happy hour tapas, almonds and olives and cheese and bread plates and things like that. I think it's going to be wonderful.
Thank you for coming in.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeff. Looking forward to tomorrow.
Juno Arts and Humanities Council Wearable Art Shows this weekend at the Centennial Hall. Now in its 14th year, the theme is juxtaposition, and artists have been preparing for months. KTO's Scott Byrne caught up with artist Michelle Morris, produced a profile, and shares this audio.
My name's Michelle Morris, and this is my third year doing wearable art. I really liked the piece I did last year, which was called CGI, and it was made completely out of computer parts. It was heavy, and to cut down the weight, I used a bunch of motherboards to make the skirts, and they were so covered in all these little cathodes and diodes and fans and things on there that it was heavy and cumbersome, so I actually took a Sawzall and was shearing off all the pieces off the top of them to make them smooth and to cut down the weight on the whole piece. It was very sharp. I had a lot of scratches after dealing with that piece.
CGI! Woo! I love it!
I'm a mom and I have two children who are 6 and 8 and in school, so of course that keeps me pretty busy, and then on the side I play hockey and have been involved in that for probably about 13 years. And other than that, if I ever get a spare moment, we're trying to be outside. We've got a boat, we hunt, we fish, and get out as much as possible. I like taking something that I think people would normally have in their household or see, and then changing that into something that they would never assume that you could use for art or for clothing. This year's piece is called Southeast Struggle, and it's going to be that juxtaposition for that poor tarp that's trying to fly away but gets snagged up along things along the way, never quite makes it. The whole process is pretty stressful, or at least I find it to be very stressful. You start off with an idea, and then you kind of work on it in little bits and pieces, and then you start looking at the calendar, and then you start going, oh my gosh, I really need to get things going, and you get rehearsals, and I get nervous even for rehearsals. I find that, you're showing a piece of yourself, and you're very nervous at how people will receive it. But as a whole, Juno is very supportive, and all the other artists are very supportive, and the people of the Jack are, and anyone you run into is always amazing, and so it's very rewarding, especially you get out on the stage and everybody cheers really, really loud, and so I find all that stress is worth it in the end. And then you kind of say, I need a break, and you put everything away and you don't touch it again for a long time, and then you think, I'm not going to do that again, and by the time end of summer hits, you start thinking about it, you're like, okay, this year I really want to do this.
Thanks to Scott Byrne for that report. To see the video, which includes footage from last year's Wearable Art Show, please go to ktuo.org. We'll hear from artist Bobby McCutcheon later on today. In the studio with me now is John Neary and Josh Howe. They're involved at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center's presentation the first Friday tonight. The topic is climate change in a new light. Joshua and John, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Do you want to start it out?
Sure. I'll just introduce Josh here. He's just up from Portland this morning, got up nice and early to get to our fair city. And he is a professor down there talking tonight at our Fireside Chat. And, the Fireside Chats start at 6:30. Second show is at 8 o'clock. That'll be tonight. And the topic is climate change, but in a different light. And I won't talk too much more about that other than just to say that I'm really excited to have him here because this is what we want to do more of at Mendenhall, is really talk about climate change, talk about it in a different way than people may be used to.
Joshua, you've written a book called Beyond the Curve. What kind of curve are we talking about? Where this Keeling?
Well, so the curve, the eponymous curve of the book is the Keeling curve. The Keeling curve is the measure of atmospheric carbon dioxide at Mauna Loa. It's corroborated elsewhere since about 1958. And the curve is a measure of the thing that causes climate change. What I'm really interested in is this much longer history of how we've talked about climate change in American politics. And it really is a much older story than you might think. It starts when CO2 gets introduced as a potential cause for climatic change in front of Congress in the late 1950s, and it shows up in Congress a couple of times, much earlier than you might think, and it keeps showing up repeatedly until finally it gets picked up in the 1980s as a major environmental issue. But this longer history can show us some of the patterns of the ways that we've talked about climate change and why we've really made so little progress in dealing with the issue.
Tell me about the curve itself.
Well, the curve itself is it's like I said, it's a measure of CO2. When Charles David Keeling first started measuring CO2 as just a background measurement, doing some completely unrelated work in California and up in the Olympic Peninsula, he noticed that everywhere he measured, his background measurement was about 315 parts per million. So that's for every million parts of stuff out there in the atmosphere, 315 of them were carbon dioxide. And that was true just about everywhere. So he wanted to measure this stuff and see sort of, is that true everywhere and is that changing? And so what he found by measuring it at Mauna Loa and a couple of other places, that in fact that background measurement is true everywhere. And he found out two things. One, it changes over the course of the year. And there's a reason for that. The reason is that in the northern hemisphere, you have a lot of land. And in the southern hemisphere, you have a lot of water. Plants live on land. Plants take up carbon when they grow leaves and shoots in the spring and summer months. So the CO2 in the atmosphere goes down, and they release carbon dioxide in the winter when they drop their leaves. And so you have this sort of measurement of the earth breathing that you can see. The second thing that he found is that earth breathing didn't just happen in a straight line. The CO2 in the atmosphere, even with that oscillation, was increasing over time. So as early as 1963, he sees this pattern. And he starts to tell people about this pattern in 1963, and it really kicks off a series of conversations about what happens when you increase CO2 in the atmosphere.
You must have some colorful conversations with politicians.
I do, and the thing that gets them is that when you see this over the long term, the great thing about studying history is I get to see things over the long term. You kind of see through some of the noise of the modern debate, right? It's a pretty vitriolic debate. But when you look at things over a long period of time, gosh, it's pretty hard to be upset about kind of the modern debate over climate change when you see how long we've known about this stuff, right? You see how well entrenched the scientific consensus is. And you begin to realize that really the problem is a political one more than it is a scientific one. And politicians end up a little bit on the defensive because they realize they've done so poorly at integrating science into politics.
Has the problem gotten worse or is it getting better?
Well, if you look at the curve itself, the trouble is that the slope of that curve was an increase of about one part per million per year until about the turn of the century, and now it's about two parts per million per year. So it looks like just from the curve, it's getting worse, not better. The good news is there's a lot of political changes that are beginning to happen. And you don't see them necessarily in places like the United Nations or in national climate policy. What you see them is right here in places like Juneau, where we have a climate action plan that was passed in 2011, where local citizens are getting together and deciding that it's the right thing to do to incorporate climate change into the way they plan their cities. So you see it in the climate action plan here in Juneau and in the kinds of programs that John's trying to put together at the Glacier Center. So to me, that's a hopeful sign. So you do actually have some reason to believe that things are getting better.
What do you see as possible solutions?
Well, so this is something that John and I were talking about a little bit earlier. Thinking about climate change in terms of a solution or a failure to solve the problem is putting climate change into a category that's different from all the other problems that we have to deal with in daily life. Those problems are like crime or poverty or drugs, where there's lots of different things that are going to help solve the problem, but the problem itself is not solvable in any traditional sense. So climate change, you have to think about it similarly. Think about how you plan your cities, right? Where do you put your transportation corridors? Where do you get your water? How you use your energy? It's all this compendium of things that goes into incrementally making a difference. And the whole idea that we're going to solve this in any one way, I think, is actually kind of a red herring. Instead, it's this much more sort of nitty-gritty thinking about how you live your daily life and what structures that daily life that really is going to help us with the problem.
Could you elaborate on the science first theory?
Yeah, so what I show in the book is that the way we've talked about climate change necessarily has revolved around science. I mean, it's this nebulous thing, right? You can't see CO2. You can't hear how 43% of the CO2 we release out of our smokestack stays in the atmosphere. You can't taste CO2 and global warming. And outside of, you know, watching something like the glacier recede over time, you really have no way of accessing global warming through your senses. So instead you have to turn to scientists in order to understand the problem. They're the people who first understood the problem and brought it to our attention. The trouble is they've also defined the conversation about global warming, and because they're scientists, it's in their nature to try to avoid politics. So their advocacy strategy has been to advocate more and better science under the assumption that more and better science in the right political hands will lead to political change. The trouble is that puts this exclusive focus on science, and we haven't focused very much on things like ethics and local community that are really going to make a difference in climate change.
And here you are at the minute on Glacier.
Exactly. That's the whole point, isn't it? He's standing right in front of a retreating glacier when he's talking about these things. And that's also what I want to say to people, too, is we really want people involved in this discussion because the Mendenhall would like to become one of those model places where we show off what a sustainable operation could look like if we really put our community resources into it.
Joshua, you're talking tonight at 6:30 and at 8 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It's a free lecture. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, I'm going to run through some of this history, some of the political history of global warming, starting with the science, but moving up through sort of the politics of the 1970s and 1980s. I can promise to tell a story about Barbies that's going to relate to climate change, and then I can promise to tell you a story about how we got to the kinds of climate action plans that I think are actually really useful and helpful in dealing with the problem of global warming.
You get a visual aid?
Oh, yeah. We'll be looking at, you get a visual of the Keeling curve, and we'll get to look at how the Keeling curve not only shows us a way we can think about climate change, but also a way we can think about American history and the politics of the environment in new ways. You get to see some historical image from some of the early scientific efforts to deal with climate change and from some of the early politics of climate change. And then finally, you get some images from some of the efforts that local groups have put together to try to make their communities more climate responsible.
How did you get interested in climate change?
Well, to tell you the truth, I went to graduate school to study environmental history, and I was positive that I was going to study 17th century French agriculture, which to most of the world actually sounds pretty boring, but there's some interesting things going on historically in that. So I'm studying this sort of early modern Europe compendium, and I had to go to this talk. And the talk was on 16th century numismatics. Numismatics is coin collecting. I went to a 3-hour talk on coin collecting in the 16th century, and I almost quit graduate school because it was I could not commit my life to studying something like 16th century numismatics for its own sake. So I took the week.
That's climate change, literally.
That's right, exactly. So I took the week off, and I came back to graduate school, and I went and talked to a guy named Steve Schneider, who was one of the lead authors of the IPCC, and I said, what can I do on the history of climate change? And he said, I'll tell you what, my office is the history of climate change. I'll give you the keys to the filing cabinets, figure out what you can do. Started the project from there, and that's sort of the genesis of the book.
And there's a film being shown Saturday.
Right, so we're going to follow up Saturday from noon till 2 with Climate Action Network is coming out to talk a little bit about a movement called 350.org, where they are focusing on climate change and showing a film about it.
I'm sure you've done this kind of talk before in front of a variety of audiences. What's what kind of questions do you get from people?
Well, so, I mean, the questions I get from concerned citizens is what can we do? And how can we integrate this in our community? Juno, fortunately, is sort of already on the ball when it comes to that sort of thing. I always see when I go to these talks, there's always somebody who wants to come and debate the science of climate change. And you can kind of see them when they come in. When I talked in London a few weeks ago, they actually pamphleted the top story of the theater that I was talking in with the skeptics literature. And what you realize when you see the talk is that I've taken the science of climate change in some ways for granted. I'm convinced by the IPCC. I'm convinced by the science. I think we have been for a long time. I'm much more interested in something that's next step. And so those folks generally don't know what to do with the talk. I get some good questions from scientists about what their role really should be moving forward and who else should be the voice of climate change if not exclusively scientists. But it's a fun conversation.
The book is called The Eye on the Curve, and the author, Joshua Howe, will be in the Menlo English Visitor Center tonight at 6:30 and 8 o'clock talking about it. You going to bring copies of your book for sale?
I couldn't bring any on the plane on the way up here, so I'm not sure if the bookstore has any that are going to be there or not. But it's available from University of Washington Press and from Amazon.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of faces from Juno out tonight.
Sounds great. Thanks for coming, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
See you.
Clive Gregson and Christine Collister. Time is 3:42. You're on Juno Karenin, FM in Juno. Our next guest in the studio is Beth Weigel from the Juno Public Library System, here to talk about an activity which is going on this next Tuesday at the Douglas Library. Beth, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, we're going to be celebrating. Well, first of all, everybody should know we will be closed on Monday. All the branches will be closed in observance of President's Day and Elizabeth Paratovich Day, and then we're going to celebrate Elizabeth Paratovich Day on Tuesday the 17th at the Douglas Library. We're going to be screening and showing the film For the Rights of All, and this film is it was made about 6 years ago, and it's got a lot of local actors in it as well to kind of recreate many of the important events that happened around the anti-discrimination bill that was passed in 1945, of which Elizabeth Paratovich and her husband Roy were both really instrumental in making happen. And she's very well known for the very heartfelt and impassioned speech that she gave right before the Senate voted on this bill. And I think one of the most interesting things about the film that I learned is that in 1945, this was the first legislation that had been introduced in anywhere in the United States that addressed discrimination and Jim Crow laws and things like that. So it was well before civil rights was taking place down in the South, and, of course, before we were even a state.
And what time does the movie start?
We're going to have a couple of things that go along with the movie as well. We're starting on Tuesday, February 17th, the movie 5:30 is when the event starts, and it's going to be a discussion as well afterwards. Jackie Martin, former Grand President of the Alaska Native Sisterhood, and she's also a current member for ANS Executive Committee, she'll be there to help facilitate a discussion afterwards. And we'll also be screening the film along with a lot of other libraries across the state. So I think right now we've got Craig and Sitka and Kenai and Haines and Cordova and Nome and Anchorage all signing on to watch the film. So it'll be kind of like watching it all together. And then the discussion, of course, afterwards will all be linked up through our online with libraries OWL video conference system, so people from across the state can talk with each other. And I think that'll be a really interesting part of this program, because there were certain key events that happened during that period building up to when legislation was introduced that happened in some of these other locations in Alaska. Some things were happening here in Juneau, and there were certainly no natives allowed signs at certain businesses and things like that here in Juneau as well. But also one of the key things that happened was in Nome at the Dream Theater. And there were a variety of young Native people who wanted to go to the movies, and they had a Natives-only section where people were supposed to sit. And one night, a couple of girls went to go see a movie, and there were only two seats left in that whole theater, and they just happened to not be in the Native section. And so they sat down, and, of course, they were asked to leave. And they left, I think, that first time, but then they came back, and they did that again, and they were taken off and thrown in jail, and then they came back again, and the one young woman came with her father because they knew what was going to happen, and he came with his money in hand, and when the police showed up, they paid their fine, and, you know, they kind of kept at that in much the same way that we know the stories of Rosa Parks and things like that sitting at the front of the bus. So that was one of the key events that really sparked a lot of just sort of dissent and you know, issues around what was going on with these sort of actions in different communities that were discriminating. And, of course, the other big thing that you learn about in the film has to do with the boarding schools and the schools for the Native children, where they were, you know, forced to kind of assimilate and study certain things and cut their hair a certain way and wear certain clothes and in order to try and demonstrate that they were civilized so that they could have what was promised, which in the treaty was, you know, equal rights. But those were denied through a couple of different actions at first. And then, you know, they tried to create this image of being what they looked like as civilized, what was termed civilized, by wearing certain clothes and, you know, learning and things like that. And that still wasn't really enough. So, You know, this is why organizations like the Alaska Native Sisterhood and the Alaska Native Brotherhood exist. They formed in order to, you know, fight for those rights, which, you know, was in their own home territory, a place they'd lived for 10,000 years. So it's a really compelling story of Alaska Natives, and you'll learn a lot about Alaska history as well, some of it not always the best shining moments when we were first, you know, as a territory and setting up government and things like that. And you'll get to learn a little bit about some of those, I guess, more flamboyant characters from the past. Governor Gruning, one of the first territorial governors, was one of the key players in that as well. And while a lot of people maybe thought him a difficult person or didn't like him, he did do a lot to make a lot of that legislation happen. So it's a pretty interesting film.
It starts at 5:30 on Tuesday.
5:30, Tuesday, February 17th at the Douglas Library, like I said.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Before you go away, what other activities are happening at the library?
Yeah, we still have the rest of the month of February in play here, and next Friday, on the 20th, we're going to have another Science Friday. We had a great Science Friday today with Legos, and we're going to build some hula hoops and learn all about the physics of hula hoops and how to keep them up around your waist with some centripetal force and away from falling down from gravity. We also have our usual third Thursday next week at the Valley Library. We're going to have some really beautiful doves come in, and we'll talk about dove care and how to have pets that are birds. We have also next Thursday our After Hours Film Night at the Douglas Library in cooperation with CIGLA. And we have another program on the 24th, Tuesday, Poems in Place. And this is a program that's we're joining up with some folks at UAS, Jonas Lamb and Emily Wall. It is going to be a kind of a combination event where you get to hear about some poetry and share some poetry about place, particularly places in Alaska, in the Alaskan State Park System, Cane's Head State Recreation Area, and Fort Abercrombie State Historic Park. And this is an Alaskan project called Poems in Place, and we'll also be choosing the nominees for this year's Poem in Place project, where basically your poetry is connected with the outdoors, so it's a response to images like that.
All right, Beth Weigel, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
All right, thank you.
This is Bird Note. This weekend is the annual Great Backyard Bird Count, sponsored by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Birdwatchers across the country count birds in parks, fields, and backyards, and then report the numbers online. Although it may seem that crows are everywhere, the beautiful northern cardinal is reported on the most lists nearly every year, far above the crow. Well, if there's a male cardinal at your feeder, it is pretty hard to miss. Birds reported in the highest numbers in 2014 were red-winged blackbirds and snow geese, with Canada geese not far behind. The Great Backyard Bird Count provides a snapshot of the state of the birds across the country. It helps scientists understand the distribution of bird populations and alerts them to possible declines of species. If you can recognize your common local birds, join the count. You can start right this minute and report your tally online. There's no cost, and you don't need to register. You'll find the link and more information on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Broadcast of this program is made possible in part by the Alaska Budget Report, specializing in the straight scoop on state government since 1991, on the web at alaskabudgetreport.com.
Gypsy, Soul Searcher, Forrest Gump, Castaway, even ZZ Top or Axl Rose. Kanan Bosler has been called many different names over the past 2.5 years. Traveling by kayak, bicycle, sailboat, train, thumb, bus, foot, and plane from Juneau to Patagonia and back, may have made him a bit rough around the edges, but he likes to think he's better off for it. His prolonged displacement from Southeast Alaska was both exciting and exhausting, and he now understands what Dorothy meant when she told Toto, "There's no place like home."
So, what's like the sketchiest thing that happened to you guys down there? This is almost always the first question I get when I start telling people about my recent trip down to South America. And I find it really interesting that I get this question so often because I have literally hundreds of great experiences that I'd rather talk about. But for some reason, I'm constantly forced to rack my mind and think of the one or two bad things that might have happened. So I don't really like this question, but I figured that mudrooms here could be a good opportunity to get past it and just get over this question. So I'll make you all a deal, all right? I'll tell you about the sketchiest thing that happened to me on this trip, but you gotta promise me you'll never ask me that damn question again. Seriously, promise? Yeah? Okay. All right. All right. Well, this story takes place in Baja, California, which is that northwesternmost state in Mexico. And for those of you that have been to Baja, you can probably imagine that it's actually a pretty gnarly place to ride a bicycle. I mean, relative to the rest of our trip, at least. Aside from being a desert in between two seas that have some pretty harsh weather conditions to navigate, it's also just largely unpopulated. And so the distances between towns can get really long, and you have to really plan ahead with food and water and make sure, because you can be riding for up to a couple of days at a time without getting reprovisioned. So it was basically like the closest we got to like wilderness cycling on the trip. But with these long distances between towns, these roads, they get really long. And the thing about that is the cargo trucks that are delivering goods up and down the peninsula, they go fast. Like, there's no one else around. So, I mean, I had this rearview mirror on my bicycle helmet, and so most of the time I could see them coming, but if I was coming around a corner or something, you know, by the time I knew they were there, they were already honking by. So it was a little bit sketchy, but anyways, this one day I was riding along, and I was actually at the back of the group, well behind everyone. I had told them to go ahead, and so I was probably a good, like, 20 or 30 minutes behind everyone else. And so I was kind of cruising along, riding, trying to catch up, pumping along, just jamming to my iPod, you know. And this northbound truck coming the opposite direction starts slowing down in front of me with his hand out the window doing this kind of stop, slow down motion. So we both stop in the middle of the road, and I say, "Hola, hay un problema?" So this is about 2 weeks into Mexico, so I barely knew any Spanish at this point, and so I can't claim to remember exactly what he said, but I think it was probably something like, "Hey, puto, ¿quieres chupar el gallo?" Like I said, I had no idea what he just said. So I said, "¿Cómo?" And this time, instead of wasting his breath with useless words, he just decided to use sign language. So he said, and he actually pulled out his taquito. No, gracias. And the last thing, this image that's burned in my memory from my rearview mirror on my bike helmet is of this old dirty pervert who I probably just thoroughly offended, his eyes locked on me, and he's frantically digging behind his seat, and I'm just thinking he's pulling out the sawed-off shotgun. So I was out of there fast, and when I came into the next town, my buddies said they thought I was a motorcycle. I was pedaling so fast. And I came in, and I told them what happened, and they could tell I was pretty shook up, and, you know, they were a bit freaked out, too, so we decided to ride together, at least for the rest of the day. But then a couple days later, we met these Argentinian guys, and they were doing the same bike trip as us. It's a couple of cyclists from Alaska down to Argentina, and they're some pretty cool dudes, so we decided to travel with them for a bit, but they didn't really like the camp was their thing. Our program had always been, you know, like stock up on food in the late afternoon and then ride out of town and go camp somewhere out in the desert. But these guys, they'd rather stay in town. So what they would do is they'd actually ask the Catholic Church in town for free accommodation. And so we got on their program this first night we stayed with them. And I mean, like they spoke Spanish, so that helped. So they kind of set us up and made us like forever remember that they helped us so much.